This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guests, Denzel Washington and LaTanya Richardson-Jackson, have gotten rave reviews for their starring roles in the Broadway revival of the influential play A Raisin in the Sun. Denzel Washington is well known for his films Malcolm X, Philadelphia, American Gangster, and Flight, and won Academy Awards for Glory and Training Day. He also won a Tony Award in 2010 for his leading role in the August Wilson play Fences. LaTanya Richardson-Jackson's been appearing on stage, screen, and television for more than 30 years. She received a Tony nomination for Best Actress for her role in A Raisin in the Sun. She's married to fellow actor Samuel L. Jackson. A Raisin in the Sun debuted on Broadway in 1959 and was adapted to a film 2 years later. It tells the story of the Youngers, a struggling black family living in an apartment on Chicago's South Side. The family's fortunes could change with the arrival of a life insurance check on its way to the family's matriarch, Lena, played by Richardson-Jackson. But her son, Walter Lee, dreams of using the money to start a business and get out of his job as a chauffeur. Denzel Washington is Walter Lee, the role played by Sidney Poitier in the original Broadway production and the 1961 film. This production has received a total of 5 Tony nominations, including one for Best Revival of a Play. Denzel Washington, LaTanya Richardson-Jackson, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's hear a clip from the play. And you, Denzel Washington, or you play...
Okay, I'm not going to listen to it because I don't like to hear it.
Really?
So,
why is that?
No, because I don't like hearing my own voice.
Well, I apologize for that. The rest of us kind of like it.
Okay. Well, you listen to it, and then LaTanya, you
and
point
I'll
at
tell
me.
Him when. Okay, and okay. Then I'll tell him when to come back.
Okay.
Okay. This is our guest Denzel Washington playing Walter Lee Younger. This is a point early in the play, where he is Denzel Washington. You're having breakfast with your wife Ruth, who's played by Sophie Okonedo. And the plot revolves around this family that's living together in the Chicago apartment, and they're expecting a $10,000 insurance payment that the matriarch will get because her husband has died. And Denzel's character, Walter Lee, has big plans to start a business. His wife, not so excited about it. Let's listen.
Walter, leave me alone. Eat your eggs. They're going to get cold.
Leader, man say I got me a dream. Woman say eat your egg. Man say, I got to take hold of this here world, baby. Women say, eat your eggs and go to work. Man say, I got to change my life. I'm choking to death. Women say, your eggs is getting cold.
Walter, that ain't none of our money.
This morning, I'm in the mirror, in the bathroom. I'm thinking, I'm 40 years old. I've been married 11 years. And I got a boy who sleeps on the living room couch. And all I got to give him is nothing. Nothing but stories about how rich white people live.
Eat your eggs.
Damn my eggs. Damn all the eggs I ever wanted.
And that's our guest Denzel Washington and Sophie Okonedo in the Broadway production of Raisin in the Sun. Sophie Okonedo, who plays your wife, said that this play by Lorraine Hansberry is so deep that the more she reads it, the more she finds in it. Did you find that as you performed it?
Well, I think that's one of the great parts of live theater. You know, there is something new every night. And, you know, it's like music. You have the sheet music, but then you play it, and there's different rhythms to it. There's different things you hear. There's things you hear for the first time, or, you know, the mistakes are the best part sometimes, too. So,
Well, LaTanya Richardson-Jackson, I hope you'll let us play a clip of your performance. This is one that we have.
I don't care.
This is a moment where the $10,000 insurance payment, you're the matriarch of the family, and this is where this $10,000 insurance payment from your late husband has arrived. And, you know, the family is divided over what is to be done with it. Your son, played by Denzel Washington, has plans to start a business. You have a daughter who has hopes to go to medical school. And at this moment, you're sitting down and you speak to your grandson, Travis, played by Bryce Clyde Jenkins. Let's listen.
I want him to be the first one to hear it. Come here, Travis. Travis, you know that money we got in the mail this morning?
Yes, sir.
You know what your grandmama gone and done with that money?
I don't know, grandmama.
She went and she bought you a house. You glad about the house? It's gonna be yours when you get to be a man.
Yes, sir. I always wanted to live in a house.
Give me some sugar then. And when you say your prayers tonight, you thank God and your grandfather, because he the one who give it to you in his way.
And that's our guest, LaTanya Richardson-Jackson, who is appearing.
Do you have another clip of that? I wasn't very, I didn't quite like it.
What was wrong with it?
I was just sitting here listening to it, saying it as I said, well, that didn't have a lot of melody.
See, that's why I don't like to listen.
Now, you see, I'm hearing a compelling performance, but you're hearing every little subtlety that didn't go as.
Yeah.
And the performance grows over time, I guess, right?
Yes, it does. Thank God for that.
Now, you're from the South. You're from Georgia. Is that right?
I'm from Atlanta. Yes, I am.
And you're, of course, a very different generation than this woman. I mean, you sort of came of age in the 60s, right?
Right. And the 60s and the 70s, yeah, I did. I came of age in it, but I remember it. I remember my grandparents and my mother and my aunts. I remember these women very well, which is, you know, the thing that I've tried to infuse into Lena's character. I remember them and their mannerisms. I remember their hand movements, you know what I mean? I remember them with their handkerchiefs.
Right. And the dialect is distinctly different, I think, than the other characters, yours.
Totally. But, oh, no, it's totally different. They, you know, they are of the North. They're above the Dixon line. I'm below it.
Denzel Washington, so, did you have a family that came up from the South that, I don't know, that evoked, you know, kind of that resonated here?
All African Americans came up from the South, either from the West Indies or through the South. You know, we were all on slave ships. And that's my, I'm sure that's LaTanya's history. That's my history. That's the history of every African American I know. My mother was born in Camilla, Georgia. My father was born in Virginia. My father was a farmer. His father was a farmer. His father was a slave.
When I watched the film, The Raisin in the Sun, I mean, it's impressive. It's dramatic. It's not especially funny. The play is very funny. Did you guys do things to bring out the comedy in it, or is that a matter of just having a live audience in front of you?
I think it's a more natural rendition of the play, that the archetypes that had to be played in the 50s, we've relaxed. We don't have to be those people now. We don't have to be the best look. You know what I mean? The best look. We don't have to always, you know, black people had an image issue, so a lot of it had to do when the play was done before and when the film was done, I think, had to do with the image that was being portrayed in a different kind of way. We are looking at this play, I think, Kenny Leon, the director, says that he's trying to make an intimate play out of a huge masterwork. And the only way that you can do that is to humanize the characters and sort of lift that onus of archetype off of them, where everything is played in such a haughty, lifted way.
So you mean
an affected manner. It's not affected that way. You see what really possibly went on. They would have killed each other if they had been in there in a space that small. You know what I mean? It would have been more fighting than was going on.
Tiny apartment sharing a bathroom with your neighbors, right? Yeah. So you're saying that
I didn't know it was funny till the first audience.
Not that funny.
Yeah, who knew? I mean, it wasn't like we were working, we were trying to be funny, you know, people. And you know, again, it's a different times we live in now. Maybe that was no laughing matter then in 1959. And now there's maybe the audience comes to with a different. And it's different culturally, racially. Sometimes when there's a predominantly white audience, sometimes there's not as much laughter because they're not sure if they're supposed to, you know. But it can be one person or a couple of people that get it going and then it.
Yeah, I mean, they laugh in places sometimes that we're like, say, they're laughing?
Yeah.
Well, LaTanya, you were saying a moment ago, were you saying that, you know, 40 years ago, to present kind of an acceptable image of middle-class blacks to mainstream culture, they had to kind of tighten it up and be serious in a way that you don't have to now?
Yeah. That's my assessment of it. That's how I see it, because it's, I remember my grandparents especially, if we were in a mix of people where there were members in white society and the white culture, she was always saying, just sit up and be nice and be quiet. You know, there was just certain things.
That's right. I remember that.
There were certain things that, you know, certain protocol that you were just asked to adhere to. That made it, you know, because you were always representing the race. Everyone was concerned with all of the stereotypes of how we were perceived. So everyone I knew was trying to undo that perception of loud, raggedy, whatever, dirty, whatever. My family was in a constant hunt to undo all of that. And sometimes they used to even tell us, if you can't put the sentence together correctly, keep your mouth shut. Shut up.
Well, you know, this play was known for bringing African-American audiences to the theater when it opened, and still is. Are you aware of that on stage, that it's a different kind of audience?
I think that's what Denzel was just saying. Yeah, we are aware.
What do you mean a different kind of audience?
Different.
Anybody that can afford to come can
No,
come.
Are you aware that the audience... It's like when there are more black people, say, than white people.
I don't look out there, so no, I'm not.
No, and you got stage lights on you, but I'm just wondering if there's a different feeling in the response that you're getting.
Yeah, I would have to look to know that it was a different. No, I don't know. I mean, no. I mean, because I don't look out there. I mean, unless somebody actually spoke, maybe I could, I could say, oh, that's a, or think. But I'm not even thinking like that either. I'm not tuned into what. Who's what color and what they might be saying or anything like that.
I'm the totally unorthodox side of all of that because I'm looking. And I can tell you that there's a difference. And, you know, we even have what I call the church crowd. I was like, oh, we got to church crowd.
Yeah, well, we know
today.
Certain days. Yeah, matinee, Sunday matinee, you know, it's going to be, you know, or if you come to work and you see buses out front, you know, you might know that it's going to be a bit different.
And what's the church crowd like?
Loud, but fun. You know what I mean? They enjoy the play. They get absorbed into who the characters are. You know what I mean? They just go with the story and they are invested. It's like, you know, even one, you know, if Walter Lee is doing something, you can hear them say, oh, Walter Lee. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I was there on a matinee.
Oh, Denzel.
Yeah, that's when they're not, like, totally on point.
You know, this production has earned a lot of Tony nominations. You, Denzel Washington, did not get one. But Ben Brantley wrote in the New York Times a piece suggesting that maybe you didn't get one because you kept your ego in check. And he meant this in a complimentary way. He said you kind of kept the phrase was the blistering and bluster to a minimum. Would you agree? Were you conscious of that?
I didn't see the article, but I didn't. What do you mean, like scene stealing or something, or when I go downstage and well upstage other people? Or something?
I think he was talking about how stars come to Broadway, and immediately they carve a space for themselves in whatever scene and say, "I'm the star and I'm here," and that he didn't do that, but he never does that.
Nah, I'm not wired that way. And, you know, I was acting on the stage long before I was doing movies. So, you know, I'm just a popular actor. I don't walk around and say, hey, I'm a movie star.
I'm a movie star.
I'm a movie star. I don't know what that was. What is that occupation? Yeah, let me throw my scarf. Get in my Ferrari.
Oh, no, don't say that.
Yeah, well, I might get in my Ferrari.
Right?
No, I don't have a Ferrari, but...
All right.
Aston Martin.
Let me get in my blue Aston Martin.
We have a few minutes left, Denzel Washington, and I wanted to talk a bit about Flight, the film that you won an Oscar nomination for in a leading role last year. This is a film where you're a pilot with a serious drinking problem and begins with one of the hairiest scenes you'll ever encounter in a film where there's an in-air emergency that leads to a crash landing, and you're the pilot. You want to tell us a little about how you prepared for the role?
I just drank every night. I got an opportunity to work with Delta Airlines in their flight simulators. The screenplay, I don't think I'm out of line saying this. The screenwriter is a gentleman who was a recovering alcoholic, so he knows about it. The director as well as being a pilot and a great director.
That's so Bob Zemeckis, the director, and John Gatton's right there, the screenwriter.
Yeah. And they knew what they were talking about. And it was, you know, there's an old saying, if it ain't on the page, it ain't on the stage. So it was on the page. And it was a role that, you know, you just, especially in film, you just don't come across really great scripts. And this was one of them. So it was something I had to do.
I want to play one scene from the film Flight. And in this film, you do some heroic things in the air when a plane starts to fall apart and manage to execute a crash landing in which most of the occupants of the plane survive. However, you were also kind of drunk and high on cocaine at the time. And this is going to be a problem when the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, gets into an investigation. And in the scene we're about to hear, you're at a funeral for one of the members of the crew who did not survive, and you approach a flight attendant who you've known for many years, and you want to talk to her about what she might tell the investigators about your condition the day of the accident. The flight attendant is played by Tamara Tooney. Let's listen.
Hey, listen, Margaret. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm in the middle of this investigation. NTSB is investigating the crash.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to him next week.
Yeah, well, I'm a little nervous because I was out the night before the crash at dinner.
Yeah, with Trina.
Right, and I had two glasses of wine, and they're probably going to ask you about my condition that morning or whether you thought I had anything to drink. What?
I've known you 11 years, Wim.
Right.
You want to tell me that you and Trina went to dinner and you had two glasses of wine?
No,
sounds like a nice restaurant. Now, which one was it?
You have to say that. It was an ordinary day, Margaret. I mean, it was an ordinary day. You know me. I was in shape to fly. And, you have a problem saying that?
It's a lie, Wim. It's a lie. Trina told me you two hadn't been to sleep.
Well, my lack of sleep had nothing to do with that plane falling apart, Margaret. I'm just trying to get this thing straight. Now, you think any other pilot could have landed that plane and saved more lives?
I didn't say that, Whip. I can't imagine another pilot doing it.
Your son, Trevor, in this church looking at you in that box. Or my son visiting me in prison and for the next 40
Whip,
years.
Enough, Whip. Don't you think we've all had enough?
I need this, Margaret.
And that's our guest, Denzel Washington, in the film Flight, the flight attendant there played by Tamara Tooney. This guy is such a fascinating character. I mean, actors love characters that are complex and conflicted. This guy is a bona fide hero, but he's also, how would you describe his flaws?
Well, he's got a serious disease, and he's a professional liar, and he's damaged goods. He's in a lot of pain, but he's also great at what he does, and he has to finally, ultimately, face his demons, as we all do. And I always found it because I made sure to do this. There's a turn in he doesn't actually turn in the film until he asks for God's help. He's on the stand, and he says, God help me, and the prosecutor, whatever, Melissa Leo says, what'd you say? Because he kind of mumbles it, and he says, God help me. And that's the beginning of the rest of his life, and God does help him, and he has to pay the price for the damage he's done. And in fact, I remember talking with the producers and the director. I was like, I think he should get more time in prison. I thought that we kind of let him off the hook, only giving him 5 years. He should have done 20 years.
You know, that's interesting you say that because that is a powerful moment in the film near the end where he's managed to cover up most of his, you know, his drinking and the danger that he put people in and is about to get away with it and somehow can't. And, you know, when you were last on our program, you were talking about the film Training Day where you play this this rogue cop. And you told Terry Gross it was really important to you that justice be served. And that meant that he not only get killed, but be, you know, rejected and humiliated by his community. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you felt strongly that this guy had to be held accountable in a way.
The wages of sin is death. And that's what I wrote on the cover of the script on Training Day. And, you know, it's not coincidental. I mean, I do this on purpose. I look for that in role, and I turn it into that if it's not even on the page. I did it in Training Day, and that's what it was for me. That was the reason I wanted to do it. The same thing with Flight. It's where he gets to. He has to pay for what he does. But there's an arc to the character, you know, like in this play or in any good screenplay or play, you're looking for the arc of the character. An American Gangster, he ends up a lonely man with a box with his belongings in it, stepping out in a $2 suit in front of a penitentiary. So it wasn't a movie about glorifying drug dealing. It was a movie about the price you have to pay for doing that.
You know, the other thing that occurred to me as I watched your performance is there are a lot of scenes where your character has been drinking quite a bit, but he's a functioning alcoholic, and he's used to covering it up. And I wonder kind of how you play somebody who's, you know, impaired but pretty good at hiding it.
Well, I think what I don't know where I learned that, from acting or from life experience. You don't play drunk. You try to be sober. You're not acting drunk. You are drunk. So you're actually trying to be sober. You know, unless you're comatose, but...
Right, but you're not drunk.
Well, that's, you know, that's what I do. I mean, I can't give you the how I do it because I don't know. I saw a play called Ruin, and Felia was in a Condola. Yeah, Felia. But there was a kid in it, and all he did was rock back on his heels. I said, man, the way you did that was great. What were you doing? He said, I just kept sitting back on my heels, but like until I was almost going to tip over, then I had to lean forward to balance off my feet. And I was like, and I started doing that, and I was like, oh. So even now doing the play, so I stole this from you. I forgot his name, the actor. Whenever I'm standing still, or if I need to remind myself in the scene in Raisin in the Sun, especially if I'm standing still, I'll just get back on my heels again. And it's just like a balance thing. So sometimes it's just something, you get a hold of something very technical, you know, whatever handle you use to get in.
Yeah.
You're also very observant, though.
Well, yeah, you got to, yeah, that helps.
You know, most of us.
Like I was watching Mom last night. I hate to talk about this stuff because you don't want to make people self-conscious.
When you say
just
Mom,
the way
you're talking
she was
about
Mom, LaTanya, rocking back and forth, going to that room to get that money. I said, look, she's putting extra on it. Just going to make me feel bad. All of a sudden, she's 20 years extra older. Like, all right, I'm going to give you this money.
Feet were hurting.
Yeah, is that what it was? Your feet were just hurting.
I just came from work. That's what I love about doing plays, though, because I get it where you get. You do it where you find it. It's like, oh,
right.
Tonight, I'm tired.
Right, yeah.
I've been to work.
It's never the same. You don't know what it is. One thing can throw you and propel you. Anything. You don't know what it is. You know, you can trip right before you come on stage, and that could inform the whole scene. Last night or whatever, one of those nights, the girls, I always call it Benita, Anika, was spraying the roach spray stuff, and it spilled. So when I came out, the floor was wet. And I got to come running across to snatch the check, to look at the check. So now I'm aware of the floor. And it actually threw me a little bit in a line. I almost forgot a line because I'm thinking about the floor. So that's, you know, it's live and it keeps going. You ain't no stopping.
Well, Denzel Washington, LaTanya Richardson-Jackson, congratulations on the play. It's terrific. And thanks so
Thank
much
you.
For joining us.
Thank you for
Thank
coming,
you.
Dave. Thanks for having us.
Denzel Washington and LaTanya Richardson-Jackson star in the Broadway revival of A Raisin in the Sun, which has been nominated for 5 Tony Awards. It runs through June 15th. Netflix has just released the entire second season of Orange is the New Black, the women in prison series that's been the streaming service's most popular original show. It stars Taylor Schilling as Piper Chapman, a woman imprisoned for a drug trafficking crime she committed a decade before. Our TV critic David Biancooley says the new season begins with a strong but very unsettling start.
Last summer, Orange is the New Black premiered the same way it's returning for season two this summer. Netflix is making all 13 episodes of the season available for instant consumption. But even the first episode of season two is plenty to remind viewers why Orange is the New Black has gotten so much attention and acclaim. Last season ended with a holiday episode, as the female prisoners put on a Christmas pageant at their prison. But the festivities didn't stay festive. Piper was threatened with death by unhinged fellow inmate Pensatucky and responded by exploding both mentally and physically. As the new season begins, about a month after that brutal beatdown, we don't know whether Pensatucky is dead or alive, and neither does Piper. In fact, when Piper is roused in the middle of the night and transported out of the prison after a month in isolation, she doesn't even know where she's going next. But on the way, with a chance to talk to the prisoner seated next to her, she finally uncorks all her pent-up emotions. Taylor Schilling plays Piper.
I did something kind of bad, and I was doing my time for it. And then I did this other thing. And I think maybe I'm going away for it for a long time.
What did you? Did you kill somebody?
I don't know. I mean, this girl, she was coming after me and she was not gonna stop. And she is, or was, she was relentless. I mean, just crazy. So crazy. And I completely lost it. I just went there and I didn't even really know that there was a bear there. But I don't know if it just grew there recently or if it's always been there, but that dark place, that place that let me just keep hitting her and hitting her and hitting her. I couldn't stop.
It's a great scene. Powerful, gripping, and totally out of the blue. Taylor Schilling carries this opening hour as Piper goes on her unexpected detour with character-illuminating flashbacks to match. But we all know Piper will be returning to the familiar cell block and all her fellow prisoners sooner or later. And thanks to Netflix, later can be as soon as you want, because you can start episode 2 seconds after you finish episode 1. Orange is the New Black is being entered in the comedy category at the Emmys this year, which is kind of outrageous. Some scenes are as intense as those in any drama series. Even so, its large ensemble cast is equally adept at scenes that make you laugh out loud and scenes that make you lean forward in anticipation. As a TV viewing experience, however quickly or slowly you devour it, Orange is the New Black is captivating.
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. 25 years ago, Chinese military forces engaged in a brutal assault on protesters at Tiananmen Square, killing hundreds, if not thousands, of unarmed civilians. Since then, China's remained a one-party state intolerant of political opposition, even as it has encouraged private investment and overseen a period of economic growth that rivals any in human history. Our next guest, Evan Osnos, spent 8 years in China, 3 for the Chicago Tribune and 5 as a correspondent for The New Yorker. His new book explores the tensions between China's rapid expansion in economic opportunity and its enduring commitment to authoritarian rule. Evan Osnos is currently a staff writer for The New Yorker, based in Washington. He was the magazine's Beijing correspondent from 2008 to 2013. His new book is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Evan Osnos, welcome to Fresh Air. Give us some sense of the scale and speed of China's growth and how much things have changed.
China's transformation, its extraordinary economic growth, to put it in perspective, is 100 times the scale and 10 times the speed of the first industrial revolution, which transformed Britain. So in practical terms, what that feels like up close is that in 1978, for instance, your average Chinese person made about $200 a year, and last year they made about $6,000 a year. I mean, in the most elemental ways, their lives are different. So in the mid-70s compared to today, a person in China today eats about six times as much meat as they did back then.
And how different is Beijing?
It's unrecognizable. That was the thing I don't think I was prepared for when I moved back to China in 2005. I actually went off looking for where I'd gone to school, and I couldn't find it. You know, I think in some ways it can be disorienting because you go to these places that made total sense. There was a sort of physical logic to the city 15 years ago, and now it's been raised and rebuilt. And it can be sometimes – it can be literally hard to figure out where you are.
Now, of course, it remains a one-party state and an authoritarian state. Just remind us sort of what the change in policy was that got all of this going back in the 90s.
Well, the crucial moment in understanding how China became this sort of hybrid between an authoritarian state and a free market economy came in 1979. You know, after 30 years of socialism, ever since the Communist Revolution in 1949, the party had adhered basically to orthodox Marxist-Leninist economics, and those had been ruinous. By 1979, Chinese people were poorer on average than North Koreans. I mean, your average per capita income in China that year was one-third of sub-Saharan Africa's. And so Deng Xiaoping, who was the leader of the country and the men around him, made a judgment, which was if they were going to survive politically, they had to get rid of socialist economics. And that's what they did. For people on the ground, the effect was transformative. All of a sudden, they started to unravel the old collective farms and the factories, and people were basically told to go off on their own and begin to find work for themselves and begin to decide what they were going to do with the little bit of money that they were accumulating. I mean, for people, it felt so elemental that the word they used in Chinese was songbang, which is to literally untie a prisoner or an animal. All of a sudden, people felt that they had been unfastened from the system and were sent out on their own.
And, of course, in the years since, we've seen hundreds of millions who've moved from rural life to factories and cities. And you tell some interesting stories which convey the change. And I wanted to talk a bit about this one woman, Gong Hainan. She grew up in a rural village in Hunan province, which I think is where Mao Zedong came from. She showed early signs of an entrepreneurial spirit, went to a factory, eventually got schooling, and she got into the matchmaking business. And the way she got into it was kind of funny. You want to tell us that story?
Yeah, she, like a lot of people her age, I think, had this strange problem she was confronting, which was that her parents were back in the village and the only people that they could introduce her to were people from their circle. And she said, no, I live in the city. I've got an education. I live a completely different life and I need to find people just like me. And she actually signed up for an early dating service and it turned out it was a scam. And when she contacted the company and said, well, why did you cheat me like this? They said, well, it serves you right. Take a look at yourself. You're not beautiful enough to be going for the types of men that you're after. And this offended her in a way that I think previous generations would never have felt. But she said, I deserve better than this. So she decided to start a company. And that's around the time I met her. She was just out of graduate school. And she was living in a tiny one-room apartment in Beijing. And she started the Chinese equivalent of Match.com. It turned out there were a lot of people facing similar quandary. And for them, it was entirely logical to go online and to tailor to their own desires, essentially, what it was that they wanted out of life.
And you learned something about their preferences. I mean, they could be very specific, right?
Yeah. I mean, they, in some sense, after so many years of having no choices, it was almost as if people embraced the power of choice. I'll give you an example. There was a young woman in the city of Wuhan, for instance, who placed an ad looking for a husband with the following qualities. She was looking for somebody who was not only a non-smoker and a non-gambler and was athletic, but she wanted somebody between 5'7" and 5'9" tall, making over 50,000 yuan per year, who was willing to guarantee eating 4 dinners at home each week and had a track record, she said, of at least 2 ex-girlfriends, but no more than 4. She also said no Virgos and no Capricorns.
How much money did she make from all this?
Well, Gong Haiyan's business was, I think, even more successful than she expected. She made about $77 million when she took her company public on the NASDAQ.
You described going to dinner at her house. You want to just share a bit of that with us?
Yeah, I went to visit her at home, and she had moved into a villa on the edge of Beijing, out in the new sort of prosperous suburbs out there. And to my surprise, the first thing I saw in the front hall was a motorcycle. The family motorcycle was inside. And I asked her why it was inside. And she said, well, it's just safer to keep it there. And I said, well, you know, this was sort of the way you do it in the village. After all, this was the old village tradition. But I said, I think you're probably okay. I think your next door neighbor is the Swiss ambassador. But in some ways, her life had transformed even faster than her own habits could keep up. And for me, at least, that really became a reflection of so much about China today, which is that the place was moving even faster than its own participants could comprehend sometimes.
Now, the woman that we just described was a classic entrepreneur. I mean, she was smart, hardworking. She found, you know, an opportunity and seized it. How much of the newfound wealth is connected to the power and privilege of party associations, Communist Party associations?
On paper, the plan was that the people in China who moved the fastest and seized the most opportunities, that they would become these pioneers. And certainly that's what you saw on the front page of the newspaper every day. You'd see a story about somebody going from a dumpling stand to owning a huge chain nationwide. But I think running beneath that, underneath the surface, there was this growing sense that actually the way to get ahead in China was to be born into the right family or to have the right connections or to pay the right bribe.
Well, China, of course, is a country that's transformed radically economically, and there's this incredible growth of new businesses and prosperity, but it is still at its heart an authoritarian state. And we're, of course, upon the 25th anniversary of the military suppression of the protests in Tiananmen Square. Do Chinese even know about the events of 1989 in Tiananmen Square?
They know remarkably little. It's dependent largely on how old you are, how much you know. You know, for anybody who's grown up in the last 25 years, so anybody who's gone to school during the last generation, the textbooks, the educational materials they have access to make almost no mention of the events in 1989. And, you know, it's worth remembering that this was an enormous moment in Chinese history. You had students pouring into the center of the capital, occupying really the citadel of party power for close to 2 months, and you had demonstrations across the country. And eventually, the military moved in on the night of June 3rd and opened fire on the students and on onlookers around the city. But if you open up a Chinese textbook today, there really is almost no mention of it.
You know, you write a lot in the book about the contradiction between the government encouraging innovation and mobility and its attempts to suppress speech and assembly. And you write about a building in Beijing, an unidentified building that's kind of at the heart of censorship and suppression. You want to explain what this building is, what goes on in there?
Yeah, I got very interested in this building. I mean, it's right in the center of the city. It's this enormous office building with a pagoda roof on it. And the first time I asked what this building was, I asked the guard and he said, I can't tell you that. And it was odd. There was no number on it. There's no sign on it. And it turns out that the building is home to the Central Propaganda Department. The Central Propaganda Department is the highest ranking censorship agency in China. And it has control over everything from the appointment of newspaper editors to university professors to the way that films are cut and distributed, it's almost impossible to overstate how powerful it is in people's lives.
And do people in Beijing, are they aware of the building? Do they know what goes on there?
They're aware that it's there. It's part of the strange paradox of the propaganda culture, which is that everybody knows it exists. It's been an essential part of the Communist Party approach to power, which is to control, in the end, the information that people have as a way of shaping their reality. And yet it also goes undiscussed. You know, that building appears nowhere on organizational charts of the party. And so the party has a very kind of self-conscious relationship with its own use of propaganda, because on the one hand, it believes that it's vital for holding on to power and for maintaining political stability. And yet it also realizes that there's something completely antiquated about having that in the year 2014. So a few years ago, they actually changed the name of the Central Propaganda Department in English. They changed it to the Central Publicity Department. But I've always found it ironic that the Central Publicity Department has no sign and no address.
Well, and you're right that, I mean, when Deng Xiaoping and the leaders back at the time decided they would retain the authoritarian structure while they encouraged free enterprise, that they also changed their approach to propaganda. I mean, it's not just thundering loudspeakers and big marches and giant posters of heroic workers, right?
No, that's what's really interesting about it. There was a point right after the demonstrations at Tiananmen Square when the party realized, you know, our propaganda is not working. Otherwise, all these young kids wouldn't have come down to the middle of the Capitol and held demonstrations for weeks and weeks. And what they said was, we need to become much more sophisticated about how we conduct what's known in Chinese as thought work. And so they began to study the masters, really. They began to study the United States and the origins of public relations culture. And so they went back and they actually, and if you look in the textbooks for Chinese propaganda officials today, some of the things that they cite are the success of Coca-Cola. They say, if you can sell sugar water, in effect, to people, well, then we can sell anything at all. They also looked very admiringly at the way that the Bush administration dealt with the press in the run-up to the war in Iraq. They think this was an example of a successful relationship with the press. And so there's been this real effort to study what's been done in the West and to take from it the best attributes, or at least the most efficient and effective attributes of the free market public relations industry.
So we have a situation where in China, you know, tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of people have seen enormous increases in their income, and they're better off than they've been in generations. And yet at the same time, there's official suppression at every hand. There's no real representative democracy and corruption that really pretty much goes unchecked. Do we know anything about how people regard socialism and the one-party state?
I think it's important to recognize that there are differences within the population. So for instance, older people who have grown up in which they remember the worst days of the Cultural Revolution, the political turmoil, the poverty that came with that, for them, China today is an extraordinary improvement. I mean, just in terms of the sheer quality of life. And yet younger people are much less satisfied because they have no memory of the bad old days. And so young people in China today are growing up in this environment where they've been raised to believe that your income is going to continue growing every year, that if you buy into the system, you get a college education, that you'll have a job waiting for you. But that's getting a lot harder. It's gotten a lot harder in the last few years, and it's going to continue to get harder. And I don't think that that population is as satisfied, and the government is actually very aware of it. They're acutely aware of it.
Do you have any insight into the debates at the higher levels of the party? I mean, you know, they watched the Soviet Union unravel. I mean, they surely think about avoiding a repetition of that.
Yeah, the government is immensely aware of the Soviet experience. They talk about it all the time, in fact. Xi Jinping, the president, says that he doesn't want to repeat the mistakes of Mikhail Gorbachev. But it also puts him into a strange predicament because in being so determined to avoid undertaking the kinds of reforms that he believed led to the collapse of the Soviet Union, it also has closed off the sorts of avenues that people have had in the past to register their dissatisfaction in China. And so as a result, you have this tension which seems to be growing. And so in his determination to hold the country together, I think he is also running the risk of actually increasing the pressure that eventually will become impossible for them to manage.
You know, in the Arab Spring, we've just seen cases where mass protests, you know, brought down governments and led to armed conflict. And I wonder if you've reflected on why, I mean, the protests in 1989, which, you know, involved millions, I guess, at their height, were so effectively suppressed, why it's so different.
The country in 1989, when these protests happened, was so close to the experience of poverty and political turmoil during the Cultural Revolution. And I think that really was an enormous ingredient, because what the government said in putting down these protests was not simply that we had to do this in order to protect the Communist Party, but what they said to the public in China was, if we did not put these down, all of you will go back to the turmoil that defined the first 30 years of the People's Republic, and none of you want that. And that message was incredibly powerful. And I'll meet young people in China today who will still say that. They say, I admire the courage of that young man who stood in front of the tank, but I'm glad that he failed, because if he had not failed, then I wouldn't be sitting here with the opportunities that I have. That's what they've been educated to believe, and for many of them, they have believed it.
Yeah, it's easy to forget that. I mean, there was starvation in a lot of Chinese territory.
There was. There was starvation within our lifetime in China on a wide scale. I mean, in the 1950s, there was a famine that killed between 30 and 45 million people, more than all of the deaths in World War I. And so anybody who was living in 1989 was balancing these two very powerful desires. One was, sure, the desire for greater autonomy and control in their lives, but also it was the desire not to go backwards in history, and they were acutely afraid of that.
Well, Evan Osnos, it's been interesting. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Evan Osnos' new book is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.